Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, so let's see. The jobs report, of course. A new way to think about poverty on the broadcast today. Also, the metaphors that we use to talk about the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday. It is the 5th of October today. 7.8%, 114,000. Those are the numbers of the day today. The unemployment rate last month, of course, and how many jobs were added to the economy in September. The unemployment report is, as you know, always an A-list indicator, made all the more so in the midst of an election. And so it is where we are going to begin today with our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Catherine Rampell covers economics for the New York Times. She is at the Times today. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville is in our New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So let's see. Jobs. Catherine, you get to go first. And the question is what? Okay. Biggest surprise for you today?
Well, the biggest surprise is probably on the household survey side, which showed that the number of people who had jobs went up by almost 900,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's a gigantic number, a gigantic, gigantic number. That is basically what pushed down the unemployment rate to 7.8%, which has caused lots of conspiracy theorists to rear their ugly heads.
Oh, yeah. We're getting there later in the broadcast.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. So that was definitely a surprise.
Okay. Cardiff, you?
Yeah, I mean, the related fall in the unemployment rate itself, 0.3%. I think you have to remember that this is one of the few times where we get a statistically significant drop, which means it may not have been that big, but it was definitely a fall. You can say that. So this is one report that I don't think you can dismiss out of hand.
Interesting that neither of you mentioned the revisions from prior months. I mean, July and August were bumped up not a small amount, Catherine, right?
Yeah, they were raised upward, but, you know, there are always revisions.
That's funny. You're blowing me off. You're blowing me off with the tone of your voice. You're like, no,
sorry.
That's not important.
There are always revisions. You know, earlier this year, we had a long string of months where they were all revised upward, and then all of these economists started raising their forecasts for the future, saying, aha, clearly this is a pattern that the Labor Department is not catching job growth all
mm-hmm.
the way,
mm-hmm.
and this will continue. And then the next month, numbers were revised downward, and you know, it's very volatile. The thing with this report is we always make a big deal out of it whenever it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much noise in the report. I mean, especially from month to month.
Mm-hmm.
And there are always big revisions because, you know, there's a big margin of error and not everybody in the country can get surveyed.
Yeah, no, I get that. But Cardiff, let me. So the reason I asked was doesn't, you know, don't the upward revisions from July and August sort of make you believe that that all the doom and gloom that we were thinking about in the middle of the summer, that there was a sag again, was maybe wrong?
It does. And it's not that Catherine's wrong. I think she's absolutely right about everything she says. But I also think that this was a very comforting report. So a good, not a great report. So it's one more data point that shows that the recovery itself has been more resilient than we thought in the worst moments. And basically, I think, confirms something that I sort of vaguely remember you saying almost a year ago, Kai, which is that the economy that we had then was more or less the economy that we'd have going into the election. I think that's absolutely the case. Doesn't mean we can get complacent, but it does mean that the recovery itself is on a pretty sound footing.
All right, good. So let me change gears for a second. Catherine, we had the debate this past Wednesday. It was economics and domestic affairs. First of all, did we get, do you think, an informative and enlightening discussion of the economic state of this country?
Not particularly. I mean, there was a lot of rhetorical talk about jobs and the need to create more jobs. But I actually went through the transcript again yesterday because I was trying to remember
again?
What
wow,
the candidates—
Wow, you did it more than once? Okay.
No, sorry. I meant after I watched the debate and I, you know, helped out with the Times' fact-checking and
all
that fun stuff.
Yep.
And then somebody asked me yesterday, so what did can you summarize what the two candidates said about jobs? And I was trying to remember what they actually said. And I went through the transcript and it looked like they didn't actually say a whole lot. I mean, except to the extent that You can extrapolate from tax policy, you know, that Mitt Romney says that if he lowers tax rates by as much as he'd like to lower them, that that will improve job growth. But there actually was not a whole lot of discussion about policies specifically targeted at creating more jobs.
Cardiff, if you could have been in Jim Lehrer's shoes Wednesday night, what would you have asked other than telling them both to shut up and keep their eye on the clock, right?
I would have asked, what would each of you specifically do about immigration reform in your first year in office? And the reason is that I think immigration is dramatically underrated as an economic, not just a political issue. And so I pretty much agree with Catherine on this one, which is that we had an okay debate on the limited number of issues that they actually discussed. But there was so much that was left out, I think, in part because, well, Lehrer just let them talk and didn't sort of enforce too much discipline on them. So anyways, good and bad.
Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville, Catherine Rampell at the New York Times. Thanks, you guys. Have yourselves a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. The ink was barely dry, as Catherine alluded to, on the jobs numbers today before the political controversy started. Jack Welch, the former and famous CEO of General Electric, tweeted this. Unbelievable jobs numbers, he said. These Chicago guys will do anything, can't debate, so change numbers, end quote. Right-wing television punditry piled on, accusing the White House of manipulating the report to dampen the president's post-debate drubbing. The Secretary of Labor called the accusations ludicrous. So, okay, all well and good. But, you know, if you wanted to fix the jobs numbers, could you? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman took on that assignment today.
Here's how this works. The Census Bureau surveys about 60,000 households, how many adults are working and unemployed. They hand the numbers off to career civil servants at the Bureau of Labor Statistics who crunch them to get the unemployment rate.
Numbers can be manipulated.
Paul Conway was chief of staff to the Secretary of Labor under George W. Bush. He now runs a conservative advocacy group.
They produce a product that is then subject to the review and approval and processing of political appointees in the department.
Conway says political appointees didn't change the numbers when he was at Labor. John Calvin's at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He's the acting commissioner. He says, yes, the president, his Council of Economic Advisers, and the Labor Secretary's staff see the report before the rest of us, but
the numbers are locked up and the press release is going to print by the afternoon of the day before, so there can't be any further change after that point.
How about the data crunching? Could the number of people working be fudged? Brookings economist Gary Bertless served both Carter and Reagan.
Either mistakes or purposeful manipulation could affect things. But the people in the Bureau of Labor Statistics are much more loyal to their professional duties than they are to the person who happens to be holding office.
Douglas Holtz Aiken served in the Council of Economic Advisers under George W. Bush. He says there's no possibility this report was manipulated or changed for political ends, but he says the household survey is volatile and unreliable month to month.
And what is very likely to happen is that next month they will walk door to door to a better representative sample of American households and they'll find that a lot fewer people are employed.
And then who will be crying foul? I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Traders today didn't seem to care one way or t'other about the state of the American labor market. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're pretty much used to high gas prices out here in California. Usually we just roll with it, but we are getting precariously close to $5 a gallon, $5 for a gallon of gas. Just last night, the price went up 17 cents. It is a little crazy making, yes, but it's also more than just a story of how much it costs to fill up. It's about a system that can seem precariously close to breaking down. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has more.
Los Angeles is a car town whimpering about gas prices. And it's not just drivers making pitiful sounds. Some independent gas station owners are throwing up their hands.
If the situation is going to stay like this, you know, I think I'm going to close down. If it's not today, tomorrow morning, sometime.
Sam Krikorian owns Quality Auto Repair in North Hollywood. Like a lot of independents, he doesn't have contracts for his gas prices.
Today, if I want to order the fuel, it's going to be like $5.05 plus the taxes, which is going to be over $5.50 for a gallon.
That's for regular.
Well, they're up the creek without a paddle.
Bob Vandervock is a petroleum industry analyst. He says there are a few reasons for the spike. For one, California has its own gas formulations, and it's the time of the year refiners move from the summer blend to the winter blend.
The switchover takes place on November 1, and unfortunately, we ran out of the summer blend last week.
Two California refineries were out of commission, another down for maintenance. There's a closed pipeline. Vandervock guesses it could add up to $6 a gallon gas by the end of next week. Or not. California's gas market has always been tight. Now we know just how tight. Back at Sam Krikorian's Quality Auto Repair, he laughs.
I don't remember what was the last time I took a vacation, maybe 5 or 7 years ago, you know, and I think it's the best time now for me to get a break.
As long as he doesn't have to drive. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I don't have any real sense of what the vast majority of people living in poverty actually experience.
Oh, we can help with that. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, even the lowest unemployment rate in 3 years couldn't boost markets for long. After an early run-up, the Dow Industrials held on to just 34 extra points, 0.25%, closed at 13,610. The NASDAQ gave back 0.4%, 13 points, 31.36 at the bell. The S&P 500 ended nearly where it started, lost less than a point, closed at 14.60. For the week, well, it was better than the day. The Dow ticked up 1.3%. The NASDAQ added 0.6%. The S&P 500 advanced 1.4%. Zynga warned of rough times ahead, and nobody was amused. The online gaming company raised 12% today. Its problems also dragged down Facebook, which earns a decent chunk of its revenue from Zynga. FB was off more than 4.5% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. Nobel Prize season begins with the announcement for the award in physiology or medicine. It's the second Monday in October, which means it's Columbus Day, a federal holiday. Those of us who still have to work can look forward to lighter traffic. And actress Sigourney Weaver turned 63. Remember how she took down that appalling alien? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl, here today with your holiday shopping update, good news and bad on this Friday. The good is that if you're a little bit squeezed, Toys R Us and Walmart have already started their layaway programs. The bad is that a lot of their best stuff has already been laid away. Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji reports.
Hey, Mom.
Hi, Annie. What's up?
How long have you been doing layaway?
I have been doing layaway for 35 years. I would call myself the layaway queen.
That self-proclaimed layaway queen is my mom, Carol.
Done layaway at the Walmart stores. I've done layaway at Kmart. I've done layaway at Sears.
You get the picture. My mom has done her some layaway. The more items she can put away, the more she will. Sarah Spencer is a spokesperson for Walmart. She says its holiday layaway was so successful last year, they're letting people put more items away.
This year, we're adding small home appliances, and then you also have your select sporting goods.
Toys R Us's holiday layaway has already done so well, it had to stop people from putting away certain electronics until new inventory shipped. Richard Feinberg is a retail professor at Purdue. He says retailers continue to expand layaway and eliminate fees to lure in broke consumers. And with a 7.8% unemployment rate, he says there are plenty to lure in.
And it's so important for them to get every last dollar from anybody. Many of them are waiving the fees and making the rules much simpler.
Layaway has Depression-era roots, and Feinberg says it works best for both consumers and retailers when times are tough. He says next holiday season, if the economy improves, you're going to be hearing a lot less about layaway. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
If you want to confuse people real fast, just go ahead and start talking about healthcare reform, specifically insurance exchanges. Insurance exchanges are where, come 2014, individuals and small businesses are going to go to buy private insurance. The federal government and some states are going to help supervise things, and they don't want people not using those exchanges because they don't understand them. So the feds have hired a PR firm to spin their message into shape, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
For most people, health exchanges are a big black box. Deborah Cholet is a health economist with Mathematica.
Family and friends are absolutely clueless about what the exchange is. What they have heard is that there's something frightening about it.
And while exchanges sound wonky, no, super wonky, they aren't as complicated as they seem. Basically, they're like the websites Travelocity or Expedia, but for healthcare. People can go online and compare health insurance plans. That's the simple message the government is paying a PR firm $3 million to get out, that there's nothing to be afraid of. San Francisco ad exec Jeff Loeb says getting people to sign up for health insurance is doable.
If I give this the right brand name, it moves the needle for me because suddenly I get the fact that this is the federal government giving me more choice about my choice of health insurance, and there's tons of evidence that people love choices.
Selling this idea is critical to the success of the health reform law. Again, Mathematica economist Deborah Cholet.
If not enough people sign up for insurance through the exchanges, then the cost of insurance through the exchange is going to be higher than the cost in the marketplace, and the exchange can't survive.
Cholet points to Massachusetts, whose exchange is called the Connector. She said state officials didn't appeal to people's minds, but to their fandom.
The Red Sox advertising the Connector during baseball games, that made a huge difference in enrollment in Massachusetts.
Not to mention, the Sox won the series. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A story now from our Wealth and Poverty Desk.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
We all spend a lot of time thinking about what it would be like to be rich. We watch reality TV shows and celebrity red carpet stuff, but imagining what it's like to be poor? No, not such a national pastime, huh? Which is understandable, because poverty's not really the stuff of escapist fantasies. But given that the number of poor Americans has been growing, it's worth thinking for a second about how they live. One approach is that you could go to a poverty simulation workshops that help people who work with low-income families get a sense of what their clients' lives are like every single day. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark checked it out.
Welcome, everyone, to our poverty simulation.
I'm standing in a high school auditorium in San Bernardino County, California. This county has one of the fastest-growing poverty rates in the country.
Thank you all for being here today.
But the 80 people being welcomed here right now are not poor. They're just pretending to be.
It's going to be an interesting morning.
One of them is James Licurdo, dressed nicely in a shirt and tie. He's deputy director of the county's welfare and food stamp programs. So you might think he knows enough already about poverty.
Yeah, but I don't have any real sense of what the vast majority of people living in poverty actually experience.
So today, James Licurdo will become...
Jack Jolly. I'm 25 years old.
Just got out of jail, has a full-time job in a cafeteria for $500 a month, lives in a trailer with his girlfriend Joyce and her baby. Licurdo reads over the sheet he's been given with his new identity and budget.
It absolutely looks like our expenses outweigh what we're bringing in.
Over the course of the next pretend month, compressed into an hour for the purposes of this simulation, Jack Jolly's mission is to go to pretend work, get pretend paid, and make pretend ends meet, starting when the bell rings.
All right, so I'm going to go to work.
Licurdo's cautiously optimistic. He's smart. He can figure this out. He reassures his pretend girlfriend.
I'll be back and we can discuss our finances further, see where we're short and where we can make up that need.
Okay. All right.
People zigzag around the room to different folding tables manned by volunteers, pretend shops and agencies, a discount supermarket, Big Dave's pawn shop. It's kind of fun, kind of sobering. Over at the Quick Cash store, a woman's discovering life without a bank account.
How much do you charge to cash a check?
10%.
10%? Okay.
Week 2. I check back in with James Licurdo, a.k.a. Jack Jolly. How's it going?
It's
Someone just handed him a luck of the draw card that says a collection agency was on his case about a car payment.
Demanding $100 or they're going to repossess the vehicle, which I need to get to work.
But he has an idea. His girlfriend gets some money every month from a government assistance program, so he asks her.
Would you mind, can I borrow some money from your cash benefits?
Obviously, we need to do this, so yeah, go ahead and take it.
I watch him take his girlfriend's electronic benefits transfer, or EBT card, and then it occurs to me.
Are you allowed to do that? Borrow somebody else's EBT card?
I don't believe you are.
Uh-oh.
No, you're not allowed to.
And he should know, since in real life he's the guy who enforces these rules.
We were about to commit a little fraud here.
Scrambling to try to get things done to meet the family's needs.
By week three, all these well-dressed professionals who'd come to simulate poverty were looking worn out. The endless waiting.
I feel like I'm at like Best Buy day after Thanksgiving.
The endless forms.
Oh, goody, something else to fill out.
What's your name?
Week four.
Can I get any of my pay stubs?
That's not the question. What's your name?
Over at General Employer, a volunteer playing the role of the boss is telling Jack Jolly, a.k.a. James Locurto, that since he showed up at work late, he doesn't get paid.
Not a single pay stub. I mean, you guys can write me up later.
You didn't work. You were supposed to be here 7 minutes. If you didn't work 7 minutes, I can't put you down as having worked.
Another simulation participant jumps in.
What?
She thinks the pretend boss is being unrealistically harsh.
That wouldn't really happen.
But in life, that's exactly what happens.
Marianella Medina is the pretend boss, and she's gone through more than just simulated poverty. A few years ago, she lost her job at a hospital, got a traffic ticket she couldn't pay, things spiraled. She's had to turn to charity to stay afloat. She remembers a day when she got lost on her way to a food pantry, showed up 2 minutes after it had closed.
2 minutes. Now, honestly, they could have let me in. But I guess the person on the other side didn't think it is important.
Medina wanted to try being the person on that other side herself for a day. That's why she volunteered to work at the simulation, to teach a lesson about what it's like to be poor. But in her simulated role as the boss of a bunch of simulated poor people, she's realized something.
Hear so many hard stories that after a while, you don't know which ones are true, which ones are a little fabricated. In order for your own sanity, you don't make eye contact. You kind of like look through, right through people.
The final bell, and the simulated month of poverty is over. Jack Jolly, a.k.a. James Locurto, runs things down. Car repossessed, didn't get paid for work because he'd been late, almost committed welfare fraud. At least he paid rent.
It's very humbling.
The MC asks people who came out ahead to stand up. Six or seven stand. But there was a rumor that someone had raided the coffee station and started dealing drug sugar packets.
So go ahead and sit down now if you conducted any illegal activities.
All in all, three families got evicted. Multiple people were in jail for traffic tickets they couldn't pay. At least two people had broken down in real tears. And this was simulated poverty. I wondered, though, if any of this would connect back to the unsimulated world.
So you can see this is pretty basic living here, and it's home for a lot of people.
Frank Heiming owns a property management company near San Bernardino. A lot of his tenants are low income, including the ones who live in this building. Heiming went to a poverty simulation a few months ago after reading about it in the newsletter.
As the simulation was wrapping up, I turned to my wife and I said, we've got to do something to help.
What he did wasn't dramatic. During the simulation, he'd realized how hard it can be to round up a big chunk of money on a tight budget. So he's changed his policy on paying security deposits. Now tenants can pay over a few months rather than all up front. It's a small thing, he says, but he's realized small things can add up. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
So what do you think? Could you live on $438 a week? Give it a try. We've got a poverty simulator at marketplace.org. Believe me when I tell you it's no fun at all trying to describe the various gyrations of the American economy, the ups and the downs and the challenge, honestly, of which metaphor to use. So for some context, we present the news team from Funny or Die.
Upsies, downsies, side-to-sidesies, corkscrews, and of course, loop-de-loops. the economy is like a roller coaster. From the familiar click, click, click on the way up, to the screaming on the way down. But who is running this roller coaster? And why have we been stuck in the screaming on the way down part for such a long time?
Well, because we're in a process of massive deleveraging where people cannot borrow because banks have decided that it's too risky to lend to consumers because of the risk that they might default.
That's Andrea Grissom, professor of economics at Ladley University, who agrees the economy is like a roller coaster.
Well, in the short term, the economy has not been a roller coaster.
The Economist agreed. It's like we're all on a scary roller coaster with a steep drop into a dark tunnel. And no one knows who is pulling levers and spinning dials. Some say it's the 1%. Others blame the government. The Space Hawk is an old rickety wooden roller coaster that audibly creaks as a cart passes overhead. I talked to Doug, one of the people standing in line, about his thoughts on the economy.
I personally think the banks are partially responsible because they gave out too much credit for years while betting against those high-risk assets.
Even though the average person may not be able to grasp why the roller coaster keeps coasting up and down in scary loops and curls, one thing's for sure. The economy is like a roller coaster, and this is one ride Americans aren't enjoying.
That was Lauren Palmigiano, Ryan Perez, and Danny Jelenic from Funny or Die. There is more at Marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which I'm reasonably sure is this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us. I have to preface it by saying I was trapped on a long flight without a book the other day, so I kind of had to watch the movie. Suffice it to say that Battleship was, without any merit whatsoever, that's being nice. But it gets us to this. Hasbro, the company behind the two wasted hours of my life that was Battleship, has signed a deal to make another couple of movies based on its board games, Monopoly and Hungry, Hungry Hippos. Always take a book on the plane, gang. That's Marketplace from APM. Our theme music, composed by BJ Liederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yours, vice president and general manager. This weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, a long look at living below the poverty line.
You and I can be busy, and we take a vacation from work. And we say, look, I'm just taking a break.
Right.
You can't take a break from being poor.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here on Monday, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.